Hey everybody, welcome to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour or so. Such a pleasure to have you with me. Thanks for joining. I've got a great interview to share with you today, and it's going to be live. August Lamb is here with us, live in studio. We're going to be talking with August here in a moment. I want to set this up a little bit so that you know a little bit more about why I invited August onto Tectonic, and why what she's going to tell us is, I think, so urgently important. Let me go back to last week's show. If you had a chance to listen to last week's show, I spoke about supervillains in tech, this idea that the tech oligarchs, what some people are calling the broligarchs, are doing, and how it resembles the activity of cliched supervillains in the comics, like Lex Luthor or Thanos or something like that. And I started with this image that I want to start again today with, that if you look at the recent inauguration and you look at the broligarchs, so to speak, who were there in attendance, their combined net worth, just those guys, whatever it was, four, five, six guys, had a combined net worth of over $1 trillion U.S. dollars. And thinking about what can we do when we're faced with such monumental odds? As I said last week, I'll say again this week, and I'll keep saying it, the fight in front of us is not primarily left versus right. It's big tech versus the rest of us. And you're going to have to choose what side you want to support. And for those of us who are fighting for the rest of us, it can be a little daunting because we're fighting against combined forces in the trillions of dollars. And you might think to yourself, what are our chances? What do we got to do? What's our next step? It all just seems too much. The forces arrayed against democracy and civility and autonomy and common sense and decency between people. These forces of big tech and their Wall Street partners are arrayed against all of those things. Well, I have some good news for you, and I've tried to spotlight some good news recently on the show because the good news is out there, and August Lamb comes to us today with some good news. And I want you to take a look at the playlist. If you go to tectonic.fm, click the playlist link for the August Lamb episode. You'll see it there. Tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Front and center, you're going to see this image, which is the cover image of this publication that August just self-published and is available. It's called You Don't Need a Smartphone, A Practical Guide to Downgrading and Reclaiming Your Life. And that's what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about what August has written and where this came from and why this is, why this is good news, that we do have options for how to make things better. So first, I want to say welcome to August Lamb. Welcome, August.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited that you're here. And I want to say thanks to listener Handy Haversack for suggesting that you come on the show. As soon as I saw your work, I said, Handy, you're right. And so here you are. So thank you for taking the time to join us. Let's first talk about this guide that you've written in terms of downgrading and reclaiming your life. What does it mean? Let's start here. What does it mean to downgrade? We've heard a lot about upgrading, but what do you mean by downgrading?
Yeah, I think over the past 10 to 20 years, the idea of just adopting the new technology has become problematic. Whereas in the past, I mean, you could always make this argument for any era of history that there's a loss with any new technology. But in the past, it would be, you know, a washing machine so housewives could save time. And now our inclination to adopt new technology in the name of efficiency has meant giving up all of our privacy, our autonomy, our individuality, our time. And so I advocate looking backwards and asking yourself, you know, at what point in history did we reach an acceptable level of technology? You know, I'm not talking about social issues. Those, you could argue, have really been improved in recent years. But just in terms of technology, what do we actually need as a society? I mean, you might say music improved through the dissemination of records. So that's maybe you want to stop in the 50s or 60s. But what is the era of history that actually makes sense for you, setting aside what other people are doing right now, which is just every wearable and smart whatever, just immediately upgrading to that regardless of the cost? And I think a lot of people would say that the early cell phones were tools. So they would help you coordinate with people. They served one function. This is, I think, is really important, this idea of a monopurpose device, which we can get more into. But anyway, the idea of downgrading is to look backwards and say, okay, is there a technology prior to this one that actually serves the function without taking as much from me? And I think that's really uncomfortable for people to do because we're so used to just looking at the latest technology and buying it as soon as we can afford it.
Yeah, you're right in this. You write in this in this publication here that we live in a society premised on progress, which discourages downgrading. And I hear you saying, just for starters, let's question this so-called necessity to continue upgrading mindlessly to whatever the companies give us. And it sounds like you're advocating for some critical thinking. You're not coming out of the gate prescriptive. You've got to downgrade to this point, use this, don't use that. You're saying, think about what it is you want to accomplish and what is the right tool or what is the right era of that tool that will help you do that.
Yeah, we don't even ask ourselves, do I need this? We just want it. And it's funny because the way these technologies are sold to us, of course, the features are listed. Like, now you can do this and it has, you know, this new thing that will make you do whatever faster. We need to do everything faster, you know. So this will help you do it more seamlessly, frictionlessly, and quicker. But there's never going to be a list in the advertisement of what you've lost, you know. So you're going to now not have this interaction you might have had with this service worker. You know, you're not going to have any spontaneity in your life or serendipity, or you're going to be boxed into this device. So all your communication will be flattened. You're just focusing on the additive elements, and it's so much harder to see what you're losing. So that's what I advise people to do.
I thought that was such a clever way of looking at this. I hadn't seen that worded quite in that way before. And I have a quote from what you wrote. You write, "It is far easier to quantify what technology gives us than what it takes away." So right. So well put. You continue, "We've gained the ability to listen to music and podcasts on the bus, but we've lost the ability to sit with our thoughts while looking out the window and watching the city pass, or strike up conversations with our seatmates, or focus on a book or a diary." And you go into some more of those activities and abilities that we've lost. So you're exactly right, August, that in the adoption of these technologies, they're sold to us as additive. You're going to gain this feature and this feature, but you're so right. It never comes with a label that says, by the way, you're going to lose the ability to have any awareness of anyone around you, and you're going to read fewer books, and you're going to have less autonomy. And you know, that should be the Surgeon General's warning, right? All the things we're going to lose.
It's funny because I spent a lot of time, especially when I was writing this pamphlet, focusing on those things that you lose in terms of your attention and your time and your hobbies. But recently I have been thinking more about, you know, this headphones thing you just read, in public and what it does to the social fabric. Like, I just came here on the train and there were so many junctures at which I just needed to ask someone, you know, does this train stop here? Or which direction is this? Is this the right cross street? And I looked around and I felt like I was really in a dystopian movie where everybody was wearing noise-canceling headphones. Right. And I was like the only person awake and alive. And I'm laughing as I say this, but it makes me want to cry. It's so scary. Yeah. So I really wanted to just turn to the person next to me and say, this stops at Exchange Place, right? And right. I couldn't. I was completely alone on the train.
You and me both. Every time, I mean, I make this trip twice a week, once on Friday to the station, Monday that is, once to the station and then later in the evening back home, and two trips a week, and it's the same experience. I look to my left and my right on the PATH train or the subway car, and everyone has their face buried in a phone, except once in a while. It's neat that it is such a monoculture of phone zombies that once in a while there's a one or two resistors who actually have a print book out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now quite often when I'm sitting near someone or across from someone who's reading a book, we'll both look up and we'll catch each other's eye and we both know what we're both thinking. And immediately we start, I've had this conversation, so I'll just say, what are you reading? Oh, I'm reading what? Do you like it? Yeah, how about you? And we have this nice conversation. We're the only two people on the car speaking to each other.
Yeah.
But it's like we're in a zombie movie together and we're the only two humans left on the subway car. We might as well talk about what we're reading.
Yeah, I had this happen actually in a public park in London that I looked around and there was only one person that I could see that wasn't wearing headphones walking around the park. And I just said, oh my God, you're not wearing headphones and you're walking around. And we had a great conversation as a result of it. But I think that this moment of recognition you're talking about kind of speaks to a theory that I have, which I don't know if it's an optimistic or a pessimistic theory, but just that there will be sort of a bifurcation in society, and that the people who want to be on the train, you know, even if the train is kind of boring, they want to be present on the train, reading their book, looking around, talking to people. And the people who just want to be in this sort of unchanging digital landscape, regardless of where they go. And those people, I mean, I don't relate to them, but they seem to be dominating our culture right now. So I just wonder if the rest of us can band together in some way, in a way that allows us to retain this right, because it could be taken away.
Well, on that point, and you write about this in this pamphlet, so many activities are now beginning to require the use of surveillance phones in order to participate. You write about tickets to concerts and sporting events, electric vehicle charging stations, digital locks in apartment buildings. You know, if your condo or whatever installs these, you've got to have a surveillance phone in order to use a surveillance app to unlock your own door to your own home. Visas, you talk about an experience you had. And then some banks now are requiring surveillance phones just to log in and look at your own account. What is your thinking since you've written this pamphlet? Do you think there's going to be a way where we can carve out part of society, culture, banking, condos, for those of us who don't want to use those? Or do you think they're just going to envelop society?
Well, I think there is a problem of once you've accepted and adopted a level of technology, it's really hard to withdraw. And so once you've said, okay, I'll get this app and I'll buy this car that kind of requires it, then it's really hard to downgrade from that point. But I hear a lot, like I get a lot of emails now that I'm doing this work publicly from people who say they've never owned a phone. And for those people, it's like they're just never even opting into those programs, or like, you know, if there's an apartment building that has that lock, they just won't move into that apartment building. So they're able to avoid that. I hear from a number of people all over the world who have never had a cell phone. They kind of think that I'm a bit of a techie, you know, with my dumb phone, for even having a phone at all. So I think it's still a little bit possible, potentially, given, you know, the right circumstances. But I do feel that, like, I'm a bit of a hypocrite because I'm saying you don't need a smartphone. And there are things like my UK visa that I had to go and use a smartphone. I could not get it's so terrifying. They needed me to do biometrics on a smartphone and fill out all these things and scan my passport with a smartphone. I didn't even know smartphones could do that, but it can read the chip in your passport. Terrifying
really?
Stuff. So I used a smartphone for that. And I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't had access to one, you know, through a friend. But I do have hope that if we just talk about this, and yes, if enough of us sort of, I mean, I would love to have tech-free neighborhoods. But that might be a little optimistic, and that would definitely be in the countryside. And it's very unfortunate for us city-dwelling anti-tech people because you're kind of sucked into the machine of it, whether you like it or not.
Let's say a little bit about your background, because as you write in this pamphlet, again, it's called You Don't Need a Smartphone, A Practical Guide to Downgrading and Reclaiming Your Life. August, you write early in the pamphlet about having been a smartphone or surveillance phone user, pretty heavy user, before making a switch. Can you talk about that transformation?
Yeah. I think that people take my message more seriously because I used to be a quote-unquote influencer. And I'm grateful for that. It doesn't really compensate me for the thousands of hours I lost to that. But yeah, I started out doing art online. I mean, those two things were synonymous for me. I started drawing and posting at the same time. And nobody saw my art except for people on the internet for years. You know, I didn't have any in-person network or, you know, friends or much less a gallery or a school or anything. It was just me posting stuff, and I fought for those followers. I mean, I gamed the system. I would go through the art hashtags and just comment over and over on people, random people's posts. Love this. Looks great. You know, super job. You're getting so much better. And just comment on people, and that would drive them to my profile. And I started getting more of a following. And then I started getting featured on other pages. And then it was my life. And it was really hard to distinguish the work of art making from the work of being a person who had the lifestyle of an artist. And I started realizing that actually the posts that captured my lifestyle did better than the posts that were just a picture of my art. You know, people wanted to follow my journey as a young artist in the world, and especially when I was living in Paris. It was the idea of it that was so enchanting to people. And people wanted to learn how to draw and learn how to be an artist, but they didn't really care about my art. So that was really rough for me to realize.
Wow. And then what happened when you came to a point and realized you didn't want to do that anymore?
Well, it's very scary because I hadn't had a job, and I'm not capable of having a job, as anybody who knows me will tell you. It's amazing that I even showed up here and did this. I'm very bad with schedules and with any expectations, any external expectations. So I was worried that I would have to get an office job or something. But I sort of made a plan of how to transition offline, because I really reached a breaking point where every time I used Instagram, I would cry and just freak out. I couldn't handle it anymore. I didn't really know what was happening. I didn't have the language to explain how my mind and my time and my energy had been co-opted by technology and social media. At the time, I felt like I was burning out, maybe in a normal way, like just from working too hard. I didn't know. But I started to look into ways to sort of diversify my income stream. So I got an illustration agent. Later on, I got a literary agent. I wrote a book about drawing. And then once I had that book in the world, you know, there was a book on bookshelves. It had my name on it. It detailed my knowledge and my accomplishments. I felt like, okay, my Instagram account could disappear and I would still be in the world. I would still have a career. And that felt really encouraging to me.
And then you write in this pamphlet about finding that you were spending time not just on Instagram, but on other apps that were calling for more and more of your time and attention. And it seemed, in my mind, I imagined you getting to a point just saying, forget it, and moving to a flip phone. Was it like that, or was it more gradual?
Yeah, it was just one night where I totally freaked out, which was that I was asked to do a panel on social media. I was asked to speak about social media on social media. So it was you know, me holding my iPhone and talking into it, and I thought that it was going to be a critical thing where we would be discussing the drawbacks of being online as an artist and how it affects your process. And instead, it was just strategies for doing well on social media. And they had asked me to, I thought they had asked me to be on it, you know, to really speak to the nuances of online art making. They'd asked me to be on it because I had a big following. So I very publicly spoke out against social media, which should not go over well. I felt so bad for the host of that show. She was extremely uncomfortable and clearly had never had a technocritical thought in her life. It was horrible. I felt bad. But then afterwards I thought, okay, I can't be on, it's not good for me. It's not good for anybody to have me be so negative online if I'm just bringing this energy. So I went on eBay, found an old Nokia, and I paid £17 for it. This was in the UK. That's like $20-something, yeah. Very cheap. Came in and, God, it probably took me a year and a half to fully switch over because I kept my iPhone because I thought I couldn't live without it. But now I can say I really don't have a backup. Pure
really?
Dumb. Yeah.
Wow. So when you had to do the visa thing and you needed a surveillance phone for that, you borrowed someone else's?
I have a friend who has an old Android phone and...
Yeah.
I don't know what it means that I put all of my sensitive information on there, but...
Oh, Google has it. Google has it.
Yep.
If it was an Android phone, what am I saying? Even if it was an Apple phone, Apple would have it. What's the difference, really? So that was your transformation, and then you found that you were able to function and live without your surveillance phone, and then you came to the realization that things are actually getting better, right? Am I right? Am I reading this correctly in the pamphlet? And you write in this pamphlet that people will spend 4, 5, 6 hours a day on apps that really don't benefit them at all. In mm-hmm. fact, you have this funny image of a chef, the spying chef is how I noted it. You write, it's a bit like hiring a chef. As a result, we've forgotten how to cook. In the smartphone analogy, your chef is also spying on you, selling your data, distracting you from your work, interrupting your conversations, damaging your sleep, and diminishing your attention span, all in exchange for those meals you're getting, which are actually bad for you. And on top of everything you've sacrificed to the chef, all the time and data you've handed over, you're also literally paying him. I thought, this is one of the best descriptions of surveillance phones I've ever read.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about it. I mean, really, it's so much time that people give away. And it's funny because I was just asked in an interview recently what I missed about having a smartphone. And it was one of the rare moments where I thought, God, I wish I'd been briefed on this interview before, because I have no response for what I miss about having a smartphone. Like, I wish I had something constructive right. to say, but I don't miss anything about it. And if I could just spread one message, it's like, I've never met a person who has regretted getting rid of their smartphone or whose life hasn't improved. Any line of work, any age, any country. And it's remarkable to me that we're all just one decision away from feeling better, and yet billions of people are just choosing not to make that decision. It's sad to me because my life has improved so much. I mean, I don't just want to say, you know, the facts of my life, like, oh, I'm more productive and successful or whatever. It's like my moment-to-moment awareness and contentedness and sense of peace and acceptance of the world. And that's really what life is, you know. It's not whether I'm getting published in this news outlet or whether I've written X many words today. It's like how I feel when I'm just sitting and doing nothing, just in my mind and my body. And that is so much better. And that's what life is just those dull moments of sitting. That's the meat of your life.
Yeah, I loved you, this came up a couple of times in this pamphlet. And I really appreciated this, August. Very, very wise words that you've put into this writing, talking about what life is. You ask at one point, is this really what you want from your life? Talking about all the apps, because this is your life. Mm-hmm. And you talked about the benefits, as you're saying, of moving off of a smartphone, a surveillance phone, in that it's not just about becoming productive. You know, so often you see these productivity guides. If you can save time here, you can do more work over here. And you're saying, no, that's not what life is. Life is being able to take a walk and not think about anything at all, or just sit and do nothing. And at one point you said, maybe you feel irritated that you're reading this pamphlet. Well, good, because you're actually feeling something.
I almost regret putting in that section about the productivity trap or whatever I called it, where people say, oh, if you spend less time scrolling, then you could work more and earn more money. I almost regret saying that because I feel like I could get more people to switch if I framed it in that way. But it just goes against my beliefs to say that, because I really think that what you're reclaiming is your life. It's not your role in the capitalist machine. It's you and your presence on Earth, because that's really all you have. And and people, they're using their time for these other, the scrolling and binging and whatever. But I feel that they are, it's like they do think they're in this temporary phase of, oh, I'm just going to do it this one time, and then I'm going to reform eventually. But years and decades can go by like that, and then you have to admit to yourself, this isn't, you know, a momentary lapse where I'm just having a tough time and I really need to watch TikTok for a few hours. Like, that's your routine. That is how you're spending your life.
And you found that you sleep better now without having all of the interaction and distraction from the phone right before you go to sleep.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. And also knowing that when I wake up in the middle of the night, I can't just reach out and check email and have the world at my fingertips.
And that's been healthy for you.
Yeah. Oh, so healthy. I will say this is where I lose people, but I want to go further. I want to get rid of my laptop. So that's what I'm working on now. But so part of me thinks, you know, that's going to put people off. If I go that far, they're just going to start thinking that I'm this like radical paranoiac. But I also, another part of me thinks if I go that step further, maybe people will meet me halfway, which is the dumb phone.
That's right. I appreciate your honesty and your integrity and your commitment to try to tell people the truth rather than bending your message at the very end and saying, well, you could be productive and make 10% more money or something like that. You're going the distance, whether people agree or get frustrated or whatever. And it's so refreshing to read this. Let me tell listeners again who you are and what we're doing here. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. We are halfway through my live in-studio interview with August Lamb, who is a writer and a visual artist. August has a new pamphlet out called You Don't Need a Smartphone, A Practical Guide to Downgrading and Reclaiming Your Life. And if you want a link to get that pamphlet, you can find it on the playlist, which is at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H tonic.fm, and find the show with August Lamb. We should also mention your website, August, which is augustlamb.com. Is that the best place to find you?
Yeah.
And that's August, like the month, and L-A-M-M.com. So let's talk. I want to talk a little bit about this idea that you just brought up about what's going to happen in a few years, because you're saying, some people say, I'll reform, I'll exercise more willpower tomorrow. I mean, it sounds a little bit like the language of addiction, right? Mm-hmm. Tomorrow I'm going to make the change, but not just yet. And here's something you wrote, which I thought was quite good. You're talking about, think about your life in a decade when you're still using a smartphone, or you point out in a footnote, wearables, subdermal implants, retinal lenses. These are not paranoid or fantastical imaginings. The technology already exists. It's just a matter of wide-scale adoption. Music to my ears, August, because I've been railing about this stuff for years. This stuff is coming. It is coming. So whether it's a smartphone or a chip in your eye or your arm or something, think about what your life is like in a decade. And well, what will happen then? So here's what you write. Quote, you will blame yourself for a lack of willpower and self-control. You will resolve to be better. You will never get better. Why? Because you're not supposed to. These machines were designed to addict you, to keep you in their thrall. Autoplay, infinite scroll, and so on. Unprecedentedly powerful corporations have harnessed unfathomable amounts of money. There again, we have the $1 trillion plus, mm-hmm. and just among these five or six guys I was talking about, and the sharpest minds of multiple generations to engineer the perfect trap. How could you possibly blame yourself for getting caught in it? So I like how you word this, August, because you start by saying the tough love truth here that you're telling people is you're not going to get better. You're not going to reform yourself. But then you reassure people it's not your fault, right?
Yeah, those are the two things that I find really hard to communicate at the same time, which is that it isn't your fault. You don't have a choice. It's a trap. But also, you can get out of it. And I think people can accept one of those. But usually when people think about, like, you open the show talking about, you know, the combined net worth being $1 trillion of all these tech oligarchs. And I think people see those numbers and they hear these stories and they just think, well, I'm so powerless against that. How could I ever possibly fight back? And to that I say, yeah, maybe fighting back actually isn't ever going to achieve anything. And that's not to stop people, but fighting for legislation, like when you look at how much money there is, where it's coming from, where it's going, are we really going to wait to change our lives until we reform these companies that have no incentive to reform? Or are we just going to change our lives today and use all that bitterness that we feel towards those companies and those people to motivate our own self-improvement? Like I just recently hosted an event that was about downgrading, and there was a guy there, and he brought up all these great points where he said, you know, these corporations and this money and this power, and my response to that was, you know, you're completely right. And also, you seem better informed about this because I'm not reading the news as much as you are. But also, you could wake up tomorrow and not have a smartphone. And right. So, but it sounds like you're not gonna.
Right. So we have, I mean, of course, we can do both. We can work on collective solutions and individual transformation. But it's good of you to point out the difference between these two paths, to say, look, on the collective side, what are we going to do? We're going to ask Mark Zuckerberg very, very, very nicely to remove the exploitation that's built into the algorithm that undergirds the feed for Facebook and Instagram. Are we going to ask him so nicely not to continue surveilling everybody through all of his apps and everything else? Please, because don't you want to do the right thing, Zuck? Or maybe we'll, you know, it just... It's a fool's errand. And legislation, I mean, there were some, I'll say there were some glimmers of hope when Lina Khan was at the Federal Trade Commission in the previous administration, and there was some real antitrust action going on. But August, there were moments in the last 7 years of this show when we were so close to this legislation or that mm-hmm. bill or this Senate committee hearing, and I was just losing my mind on this microphone right here and say, just do it, just do it, just, you know, pass it, pass it. And none of them ever passed. And I'm with you, August. I mean, it's been so many years, and I'm looking around and now at the present, you know, occupant of the White House and his favorite billionaire who's calling the shots. And it just doesn't look hopeful that the collective solution is going to have legs, certainly for the next 4 years. So the alternative to this, you said, is you can make changes yourself right now. I mean, so let's talk about the individual path. What is, we'll say more than just this, but what is one thing that you would start someone off, August, with if they're saying, okay, I'm intrigued, I like what you're saying, I don't want to go full August Lamb just yet, but what is one step I can take where I'll be able to prove to myself I feel better already?
Well, just one thing about your previous point. I don't think that collective and individual action are mutually exclusive, because who's better equipped to pursue collective action? Somebody who's scrolling on their phone all day or somebody who's woken up to what life can be like when you're not
good point.
Under the control of these corporations.
Good point, good point.
So I advocate for people getting offline in order to pursue all sorts of political action. But anyway, yes, the question of the first step or a small step, I always struggle with so much because I see people take these small steps. I think most people out there, even the most addicted people, have already taken those small steps. You know, they've set limits. They've downloaded app blockers. They've put their screen black and white. They've left it at home, left their phones at home when they go out and do something. You know, I just see people pursuing these measures, and I did that myself when I had a smartphone, and it creates more stress. It actually, I was thinking about it recently. Like, what's an analogy? I don't think it's a perfect analogy, but it's sort of like trying to recover from alcoholism and putting like a bottle of whiskey on a pedestal in the middle of your living room and being like, I'm not gonna drink that, you know, because it just emphasizes it more. It draws your focus toward it. It creates another job. So in addition to being anxious and overstimulated all the time by your phone, you're also anxious about adhering to these rules, and you have to keep renegotiating them and saying, well, but now I'm on a plane, so does the rule about watching movies on my phone apply? you're always asking yourself that. So it's really tough. I want to have a nice thing to say to people, but really I'd say step one is start reading books about what is really going on in the tech industry, what is going on in your own mind. I think people respond to different scales. I personally do better with a more individual scale, but some people are more moved by systemic ideas and problems. So read about it, think about it, and I would say save up all that radical energy for a big change rather than making these little incremental changes that are just going to drain you further.
And then, so you do have a reading list at the end of the pamphlet, and it has books like The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt and The Age of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff, who's been on the show. In fact, listeners could do worse than to go to the reading list at tectonic.fm, the books that I've covered on the show. There's 135 of them, and many of them make some of these same points. All of the harms of this surveillance big tech economy on all of us individually and collectively. And yeah, I like this idea. Build up your rage until you're ready for a radical step, which is what, August?
The radical step is getting rid of your smartphone. I don't think there's any way to be radical at all in the world. And I'm talking like radical, you know, having avant-garde style, like anything, radical musically, radical creatively, in any way, like it just socially radical, breaking the script, like doing something unusual, starting an exciting new business. I just think you cannot be radical if you are adopting this technology that, first of all, everyone has, but second of all, is pushing you into homogenization. And everything you receive on your phone, everything you receive on social media is tailored to you and is molding you and shaping you in some way. It's not random. It's not finding a book on the side of the street. It's being served up to you, and there's a profile of you, and all your likes and dislikes, as accurate as that may or may not be, there's a profile of you out there in your demographics, and you are being shaped into that or into something different. And there's no escaping that. And so I think having a smartphone is just like, it makes originality a lot harder. It makes it really hard to know if your thoughts are your own. And I don't want to sound too paranoiac there, but really, like, I often talk to people, like, so I travel around a lot and do events in different countries. And sometimes I'll be in London one week and then I'll be in New York the next week. And, you know, my British female friends and my New York female friends are both saying, like, they have the same ideas, but they're not saying, oh, I saw this on a TikTok. They're just saying, I've been thinking a lot about this recently. And, like, you know, this has come up for me. And I think I'm going to go back and read this book. You know, and it might be a classic. It's not even a new book. But they're both saying the same things because they both, without really realizing it, they've been in the same corner of the internet. And that frightens me.
Yeah, there's a monoculture that's developed. That's right. Do you also have some friends who have gotten rid of their smartphones? And what sort of conversations do you have with them?
God, I wish I had more. I've met people through this movement. Thank God. Oh, I like that's really the best thing that this work has given me is hearing from people who have similar aims. It's such a small world. I call it tragically small, this anti-tech world. We all kind of have heard of each other, people who are really public advocates or writers on this subject. So I've made friends with those people, and I'm not sure that I would get out of bed in the morning if I hadn't met those people, because it gets worse every day. You know, it gets worse in terms of the news, but also just what we're surrounded with when we walk through cities. And so having these people in my life who are living similarly, so when we hang out, I don't feel like they're about to pull out their smartphone at any second. And when I come back from the bathroom at a restaurant, they're just sitting there. They're just sitting there looking around, and I just want to hug them when that happens. So that we can discuss this stuff. We can discuss the paradoxes and the ironies of being an anti-tech advocate and having to, you know, go on these Zoom meetings to talk about this right all the time. And so I'm so grateful for those people. But none of my longstanding friends have in any way changed the relationship to technology as a result of my work. So that's tough, because those are my closest people.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the devices that you do recommend. You have a purchasing guide in this pamphlet. Again, it's called You Don't Need a Smartphone, A Practical Guide to Downgrading and Reclaiming Your Life. And you've got three or four recommendations for flip phones, well, non-smartphones, I should say, non-surveillance phones. They're not all physically flip phones. Do you have one that you would recommend to listeners if they want to go onto eBay right now and find one?
Well, the unfortunate thing is that the networks have been upgraded in the U.S., so you can't use vintage phones, if you want to call them that. And that's sad, because not only is the design more pleasant on those phones, but they're actually the only simple phones that exist. So in the UK and Europe, you can still use these early 2000s phones, and they're amazing. I love them to death, because all they do is text and call, and you type out the message and you press send. Like, there's no, the screen is one color. It's amazing. And then these US phones, these modern ones, I don't want to do them dirty, because then people are going to be like, "Oh, well, I won't switch." They do their job, but they're not cute, you know. They're not, and they try to tread a middle path between dumb phone and smartphone. And so they say, "Oh, you know, you can do a Google search on here," but it's this tiny little, it's 1 inch long, the search bar, and you've got to like type it in with T9. Right. But yeah, if you go to just Best Buy or your local cell store, they'll probably give you a Nokia 2780, which is a flip phone. It does the job. It's kind of cool looking. I mean, it's fine. I've had one for years. It works.
And you also mentioned the Light Phone. One of the founders of the Light Phone was a guest on the show early on, soon after Light Phone launched. Where do you think the Light Phone fits into that ecosystem?
So I just a few days ago, I got a drink with someone who works at Light Phone. And I really railed against the new Light Phone, which in my opinion is pandering to the addictions that are instilled by a smartphone. So it has a camera, you know, you can listen to music on it. It kind of looks like an iPhone. And my opinion is we should be questioning whether these tools are really necessary or whether they might be more enjoyable and more meaningful if they're disambiguated, so we have a separate camera. And, you know, like, I got a dictaphone recently, so if I'm working on a song that I like, I can record it on my dictaphone. And when I pick that up and I press record, it's not like, do you also want to take a photo? Do you want to send an email? You know, it's just the one thing, and I love those things. So I got in a bit of a debate with this guy who works there, and his argument was social media is really the problem, and if we don't have that on our phone, like, it's such an improvement. And a lot of people don't switch because of these features. They're so panicked about navigation or something that they'll never switch. And I thought about it, and although it's not radical enough for me at all, and I think it kind of just leaves people halfway to recovery, and that makes me upset. I did have a little talk with myself, and I decided that if everybody had that phone with those features, it would still be a better place than if everybody had a smartphone.
Yeah, that sounds right. And I also do like your point about the disambiguation, which you write about in the pamphlet, saying, wouldn't life be better if we had one tool to do one job? Or for each job, there would just be one tool for it. So like you said, if you want to text or make a phone call, you use a phone. But if you want to look at your face, don't use the camera on the phone. Use a mirror. We've had the mirror as a technology for thousands of years. If you want a flashlight, here's an idea. Use a flashlight.
Yeah, I actually had an idea for an anti-tech ad campaign, which I'm sure one of your million listeners is going to steal now that I say it on the air. But it's like a person sitting on a subway, because we were talking about people using their devices on public transit. So sitting on the subway, and they have in their lap and surrounding them, you know, a typewriter and a camera, you know, and like in a telephone and a flashlight and a mirror and like a little chess set and just everything all there, crosswords, newspaper, books, like splayed across their, like just in such an inappropriate way in public, right, to be doing all of these things. But to have this person that's so distracted and overstimulated and over preoccupied by all these things, but in public and everybody else just trying to be on the bus or whatever, and this person's brought their whole life there. And just how small we've made those things, you know, and that's supposed to be a good thing. It's like, oh, great, we've taken this object that brought people a tactile pleasure and a sense of focus and absorption, and we've flattened it into an object that contains everything else.
Right, right. And I remember when these surveillance phones were first launching, there was an ad campaign that was the flip of that. Mm-hmm. They showed all those devices and said, now it all fits in one device.
Yep.
As though that was a good thing.
As though we all hated having a guitar. It was
right.
Awful.
Oh, you remember that Apple ad campaign about a year ago?
They crushed
the guitar.
Yeah.
We despise human beings.
I still can't understand. Was that meant to be ironic?
No.
Okay.
They thought it was just the supreme heights of arrogance that Apple goes to. We're going to crush your life, and you're going to overpay for our surveillance device, and you will thank us and line up for the next one. I mean, it was just outrageous.
But that brings up the way that this digital attitude has bled into our physical spaces, and that they all kind of look like what you might imagine it to be like if you were to fall into a phone. You know, you go to a cafe and it's just like white, gleaming, clean, empty space. A lot of homes are like this nowadays. They've got no sort of distinction because of this monoculture. And you could go to a home in Tampa or a home in London, and it's got the same kind of beigeified, gleaming surfaces of nothing.
And a giant screen on one wall.
Because the screen contains all the culture that, right, you know, objects and artifacts would have contained.
That's right. We just have a few minutes left, August, and I wonder, you know, Tectonic is a unique show in that I am completely aligned with what you're saying, what you've written in this pamphlet. I don't find it paranoid at all. I think it is totally accurate. So this is a venue, and you're among friends here. Is there anything that you always want to say on these events and podcasts and everything, but the host never asks you, or you feel a little bit uncomfortable saying it or going there? What would you like to tell the listeners?
I'd just like to say that doing this work and thinking about this all the time, which is the last thing I want to do as someone who's deeply upset by this, it does push you to a point of despair where you have to think about this every day, and you're hyper aware of this because it's something you're writing about and talking about all the time. And it's really hard to confront where we're headed as a society. And I go to dark places. I'm not talking psychologically, like I'm okay, but dark places in terms of my predictions for the future. And I don't ever talk about that because I want people to think like, yes, we can all just get rid of our smartphones and everything will be fixed and fine, you know, and because I want people to do it. But do I think that people will? You know, what's the percentage of, what's the ratio of people who've downgraded to people who've bought the pamphlet? I think it's like probably 1 in 1,000. And to think that I'm told over and over again how convincing and how compelling this pamphlet is, and it's still not even, like, it's not sending anyone over the edge. That's like, that I find that really demoralizing. And so when I think about the future, I start to wonder, like, will I be able to have friendships with people who are on social media and who have smartphones? Is that going to change? Are we reaching a point where, like, there will be no common ground between those people? Am I going to have to take more radical action? Am I going to have to leave these cities and not be a part of society anymore? So that's like, if I'm given the safe space to get paranoid. And these are the things, if you want the behind the scenes of what the anti-tech activists talk about when they're in private,
yeah.
It's this kind of stuff. It's like, are we really going to make any difference?
Well, you are making a difference. And you have helped me. You've inspired me. And it's such a privilege to be able to spotlight your work to Tectonic listeners, for whatever that's worth. And I want you to know, August, wherever you go, whatever remote area you have to go live in at some point, you're always going to be welcome back here at Tectonic, okay?
Thank you.
You're a friend of the show, so come back. I want to thank August Lamb so much for being with us. Thanks, August, for taking the time. This has been great. You have been listening to my interview with August Lamb, visual artist and author of an important new pamphlet called You Don't Need a Smartphone, A Practical Guide to Downgrading and Reclaiming Your Life. You can get that pamphlet if you go to August's website, which is augustlamb.com. That's Lamb with two M's. Or there's a link to it on the playlist, which you can get to at tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. I also want to remind everybody that there is a movie night coming up next week here at WFMU that I am hosting. This is going to be on Thursday, February 20. It's WFMU Film Night. We're going to be watching a documentary called Flash Wars, Autonomous Weapons, AI, and Warfare, about the role of new technology in the waging of war. This is going to be an important conversation. We're going to have a Zoom interview with the director. That's, again, Thursday, February 20. Doors at 7:30 p.m. I hope you will join me there. There's a link to it on the playlist, or you can get to it from the WFMU.org homepage. And that's about all the time I have this evening. August, are you still with us?
I'm here.
There's this funny thing that I do at the end of every show, and it's my version of your pamphlet. And similar to you, I've been saying this for over 7 years, and I don't know how many people have actually followed these instructions, but I'm going to keep saying them anyway, because that's what we do, August. We just tell people what we think is the truth, and maybe it'll land somewhere. And it helps some people. And even if not, we have our friends here and with our listeners who are listening to us, and that's all we can do.
If it impacts one person, that's a whole world. That's a whole life.
And here is the suggestion, the recommendation, the homework for next week, friends. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. You have been listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, and 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. And I thought this evening we would go out to an outro song that was recommended by Amanda of the Nazario Scenario. This is a song by Andrew Thompson called We're in Business, which seemed appropriate for this evening. Please stay tuned for Dave Mandel. Have a great week, everybody. I'll see you next time.
Hey, Andrew.
What's up, robot?
I love you.
I know you do.
Hey, Andrew.
What is it, robot?
I love you.
I know you do.
Hey, Andrew.
What's up, robot?
I love you.
I know you do.
Hey, Andrew.
What's up, robot?
I'm going to kill you.
Oh, my God. Never trust robots. Never trust robots. You might think that they're your friend. They'll only kill you in the end. Never trust robots. Never trust robots. Don't leave them with your kids. Don't invite them to play bridge. If you're a human being, we're in business. If you're not a machine, we're in business.
If you're not me,
we're in business. We're in business. Never trust robots.
Hello, hey, good evening, and welcome to another episode of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. A pleasure, always, is what it is to be here playing music for you. Thanks for joining me. We are going to begin tonight's show. I'm going to dive right in to our friends over in France. Dive into, well, it's you. Weird mixed metaphor there. You get the basic idea. We're going to hear a French group called Chromb, C-H-R-O-M-B, with an exclamation mark on the end. It's too early in the show to shout out the name because it has an exclamation mark on the end. So just imagine me shouting, screaming the name Chromb, C-H-R-O-M-B, exclamation. We're going to hear a track from a compilation. I guess maybe you'd call it a sampler because it's a collection of bands on a French label called Dur et Doux, soft and sweet, I guess would be the translation. And it's a very mixed compilation. It's not all proggy stuff, but some of it is, and that's the part that we are concerned about here, concerned with, preoccupied with. So we're going to hear a track from the group Chromb. It's called Le Tombeau est Vide. The coffin is empty, I'm going to say, sort of swaggery math rock from this band who are from Lyon, France. Here we go.
Yeah. Cependant, contre toute attente, la terre du tombeau ne gardait pas le souvenir de son Nautilus quand il revint. Décédé, ressuscité, redécédé, ressuscité, cette fois le tombeau est vide. Combien de temps le restera-t-il?
Le tombeau est vide.
S'il n'avait jamais été vide, mais au contraire plein de denrées alimentaires, il aurait fallu vérifier tous ses pantres, et les sucs sont certainement perdus désormais.